So we're spending a couple of weeks on this topic of friendship. And last week, we noted the rather desperate state of loneliness that is just sort of epidemic in our society. And I appreciate the emails and conversations I had with several folks who just talked about the truth of the loneliness that so much of our society faces. And last week we looked at four enemies of friendship, four things built into our society, and one of them in particular with the church that defeats friendship and remains, causes it to remain alienated. We talked about the idolatry of freedom and how actually friendship by its very nature curtails our freedom. And as long as we're going to uphold freedom as the ultimate value, our friendships can never quite be deep enough. We talked also about fear. The fear of rejection, either of an initiating friendship or, in fact, the pain of having somebody who was a friend walk away from us. We talked about consumerism and how that drives our life and how so often our relationships tend to be almost commercial in terms of the advantage that we need to have and gain from each other. And when that advantage disappears, so often does the friendship. And then we looked at that weird one, the ascendancy of agape. Remember the whole four Greek words for friendship? And we talked about how Christianity came into the Greco-Roman world and absolutely changed friendship. All of a sudden, through different strata of society, we could be friends. But then this whole thing, that this Christian value of agape love, the God-kind love, the self-sacrificing love, and how as that ascended and as people came to realize more and more that this is a mark of a Christian, somehow it got turned on its head and became something that began to say, well, really, then you can't have close friends. Really, we need to, if we're to love our enemies, then surely we're to love everybody equally. And for later, this friendship love sort of disappeared. And then actually at the end, we saw how the other kinds of love, storge, family, eros, sexuality, also diminished friendship. So our assignment last week was to turn to hunt down some of these enemies of friendship in our life and assassinate them. That was kind of the thing, get rid of that stuff. But today, let's get on the positive side of things. Let's begin to talk about some qualities of a true friend. Some qualities of a true friend. Now, what's really important to understand is that these are things that we need to put into our life. You know, in his book, Atomic Habits, James Clear said this: every action we take is a vote for the person that we want to become. It's kind of an interesting thought, isn't it? I mean, we've got this idea of who it is that we want to be, and every action we take in life, every habit we have, it builds towards that person, positive or negative. And so what we want to talk about today then is what action do we take in order to be a good friend, in order to gain friends and bless other people. Now, I don't know about you, but for many of us, when we think about the Bible and friendship, the friendship that comes to mind is Jonathan and David. I remember saying this. I was saying, well, Sheena, you know, the next one, doing this thing on friendship. And Sheena said, oh, that's going to be a problem, because the one everyone jumps to is this homosexual thing, conversation that goes on. And so, to which I, of course, said, what do you mean? That's exactly the text that we're going to go towards. And she said, you don't back away from anything, do you? I said, we're going to talk about this stuff. So I want to talk about, first of all, this friendship between David and Jonathan. And I want to talk about it from sort of two sides of the coin. I want to talk about the question of it being a homosexual or homoerotic relationship or a deep covenantal friendship. My goal is to look at this seriously. We need to talk about this stuff and to look at it honestly, hopefully, and see what we find in there, and to equip ourselves to have this conversation with sincere people who disagree with people like me. But we want to talk about this, but also glean some other things from it. So let's jump into this whole thing of Jonathan and David, and I want to talk about my suggestion that it is, in fact, a great story about Jonathan and loyal encouragement. All right, let's take a look at some of the major passages that deal with this relationship between Jonathan and David and see what we can learn, because I want to say that it's a non-erotic intimacy. So, kind of starts off, you remember in 1 Samuel chapter 17, David goes out. We looked at this a couple of weeks ago, you know, kills Goliath. Saul takes him into the household. And then this is how chapter 18 begins. After David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. Kind of like Jesus suggests, that we're to love one another as we love ourselves. So here's this first thing. So Jonathan loves David. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return to his home family. In other words, what happened here is that King Saul brings David into the family unit. Okay, that's kind of, you won't let him go home to your family. Now you're part of my household. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. And Jonathan took off his robe that he was wearing. This is really, really important, guys. And Jonathan took off his robe that he was wearing, and he gave it to David along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. All right, so here's the first kind of indication that people would say, you know, there's something weird going on here in terms of it being different. Like, what's all going on with this love language and giving up clothing and this sort of thing? It's more than just a normal friendship. All right. What's going on here is that Jonathan and David are making a covenant. You see that there? He made a covenant with David because he loved him. One of the things we need to realize is if you study both the covenants in the Bible, but also in the Near Eastern covenant making, this language of love is very common in covenant making, how the vassal loves the Lord and the Lord loves the vassal. So love language is very common in covenant making. It's the language of making a covenant. Next thing. What's going to happen here, in a subtle way that we maybe miss because we don't understand the subtleties of the culture, is that Jonathan is proclaiming that David is going to be king and not himself. That's what this whole gifting of his tunic and his cloak and his sword and his belt. It's not a love gift to David. This is a profound act on the part of Jonathan, who takes a look at the land, understands who David is, understands what David has just done, understands the nature of his father, and has this understanding that David is going to be the next king. And this is David surrendering up the symbols of his ascendancy to the throne and giving them to David. It's a love gift in a sense, but it's a love gift in the sense of, you, David, are going to be the next king. Now, if you go over into chapter 20, verse 30, you've got Saul, who's kind of reaming out his son Jonathan. And he says to Jonathan, because of your relationship with David, you have shamed your mother's nakedness. You have shamed this family. And some folks say that this is Saul wrestling with Jonathan being homosexually attracted to David. But really it has to do, I want to suggest that no. This is Saul really angry that Jonathan has already submitted to David and said, you are going to be the king, not me. And in being such a pansy, of backing away from this and proclaiming him as the king, you have shamed your mother. You have shamed this family. That's the relationship that is a shame to their family. And so David is welcomed into Saul's family as kin. He becomes kin. He becomes a brother to Jonathan. And Jonathan makes covenant with him in deep friendship and says, you are going to be the next king. All right. Next passage that kind of comes up that's an indication of their relationship is this. After the boy had gone, so this is, you know, when Jonathan is warning David that his dad Saul is going to kill him, and they make an agreement, you know, well, we'll meet out in the field and I'll let you know if your dad's really going to kill you. Then we pick up this. After the boy had gone, David got up from the south side of the stone and he bowed down before Jonathan three times, his face to the ground. Then they kissed each other, and they wept together. But David wept the most. And Jonathan said to David, go in peace, for we have sworn friendship with each other in the name of the Lord. That's a covenantal reference, of course. Saying the Lord is a witness between you and me, between your descendants and my descendants forever. Then David left and Jonathan went back to town. All right, what has happened here is that it's become obvious in the story that the household of Saul and the household of David are going to be in opposition to each other. There's going to be a battle. There's going to be rivalry between the two households, mostly because of what Saul does. And these two friends realize what's going on. And so they renew their covenant with each other, and then they separate. Now, here's the thing to understand. Men kissing each other is not necessarily a homosexual or a homoerotic activity, in particular in that culture. This whole thing, that the Hebrew word for kiss here, you know, it appears 27 times in the Old Testament. And 24 of those times are non-erotic. 15 of them are between relatives, usually between fathers and sons and brothers and so on, kind of like the kinship. And the other ones, there's some that are unrelated males. Samuel kisses Saul. Absalom kisses everybody. This whole thing when Absalom, David's son, is trying to get the nation on his side because he's going to try and usurp the throne. Remember the story? He goes out and he stands outside of Jerusalem and there's people come to the king to put down their complaints. Absalom's like, oh, if only you had somebody. If only you had someone to listen to your case. Let me listen to your case. And as they went, then he kissed all of these people as a welcome, as a gesture of, I'm going to stand up for you. King David kissed Barzillai after when he was saying goodbye to him. And Joab treacherously kisses the general Amasa as he takes him by the beard to kiss him a greeting and then stabs him with his sword. And so you see, there's this cultural thing that's happened. Now, in the times that it does happen in an erotic way, three of the usages are in the Song of Solomon, which, of course, is an erotic love poem between a bride and a groom, and Proverbs 7:13, which describes the action of an adulterous woman, where with her brazen face she kisses the youth. The dominant expression of kissing in the Old Testament is one to do with non-erotic relationship and welcome and covenant-making and kinship alignment. And so to take this into this passage and to say, well, see, look at this here. This is them kissing. This is an erotic movement. Culturally, in all probability, I want to suggest it was not. All right, let's go to one more towards the end of it in 2 Samuel chapter 1. This is a poem after Saul and Jonathan had been killed in battle. Okay, David writes this, sings this. Daughters of Israel, weep for Saul, who clothed you in scarlet and finery, who adorned your garments with ornaments of gold. It was a prosperous time when he was king. How the mighty have fallen in battle. Jonathan lies slain on your heights. I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You were very dear to me. Your love for me was wonderful, more wonderful than that of a woman. That's the phrase that's so often picked up on. How the mighty have fallen. The weapons of war have perished. Jonathan had always demonstrated kindness and love to David. He went so far as to side with David against his own father and covenantally agree to surrender the throne to David. These were greater acts of love towards David than any woman had ever shown him. It's a love, a deep love, though I want to suggest a non-erotic love. As a matter of fact, I think that David is making something that's actually kind of clear. He's making a clear distinction between women and men and loving one another. He's saying, on the one hand, listen, you need to understand something, that my love for you is so incredibly deep. I can only use love language. I can only use language that could be construed in other relationships that are so deep. And that is the love of a man for a woman and the love of a woman for a man. It's this deep, but you need to understand that this is a different kind of love. It's love like no woman has ever showed me. It's a superior love. It's a better love than any woman has ever shown me. And so rather than putting it together and comparing it, this is an erotic love, and his homosexual love for Jonathan was deeper than his love or another woman's love for him. He's saying, no, this is different. It's deep. It is intimate. It is profound. It is life-changing. It is solid. It will dictate the course of our lives. But it's non-erotic. You know, I think that there's such a powerful tendency in our society to see any deep love as necessarily erotic. As a matter of fact, it's kind of a shock when things would happen that there's this kind of intimacy, this kind of love, when it doesn't become erotic. Joanne Lumley, a book called Friendship by Victor Ostenin, and he talked about the well-known and well-acclaimed movie Lost in Translation. Have you ever seen it? It's 2003 now, but it's got Bill Murray in there and Scarlett Johansson, the director Sofia Coppola. And it's this older actor who's kind of lost it, and this young bride, and they're away from their spouses, and they meet, and they strike up this friendship. And it talks about how in the movie everything's lined up, that everybody expects them to have an affair. Everybody expects it to turn sexual. But the power of the movie, the shock of the movie, is that they don't. They're able to have this deep friendship, this connection of the soul, which does not include erotic love. And it's a shock to everybody. It's part of the reason the movie is so powerful, is because it explores the possibility of having deep friendships without sex. Niobe Way, a sociologist at New York University, published a book, a study of several years of study of the developmental relationships between adolescent males. The book is called Deep Secrets: Boys' Friendships and the Crisis of Connection Leading to This Loneliness Amongst Men, which we've talked about before. And she said, well, what's interesting in the study is that when they interview and talk to young teens about their best friends, their boys who are best friends, they use incredibly intimate language. Just a language of love and appreciation and openness and all of these things. But as they tracked these boys going through adolescence, by the time they get up into their upper teens and into college and university, the language absolutely changes. It changes. And those relationships that remain close, oftentimes when they speak with loving, intimate language about their friends, they'll preface it or conclude it by saying, no homo. Love your brother, no homo. And those of you that have got teenage kids, you hear guys say this. Why is that happening? Because there's this assumption that has happened with the victory of eros above every other kind of love in our society. All of a sudden, everything just assumes, I mean, if there's intimacy, if there's love, there's got to be homosexuality. You know, I kissed a guy once, it was on his wedding day, David Hockley. Didn't kiss him on the lips. I kissed him. He was my best friend. We got all through college together, walked through all kinds of stuff. But I guarantee you, there is no eroticism either way. There's intimacy. There's friendship. There's willing to lay down your life. And the language and the gestures can be profound. And so we can't go around leading back eroticism into every relationship and every friendship that's deep and intimate. If we do that, then it's going to break friendships. It's going to continue to alienate men for sure. And we know that there's a profound alienation. I can't speak for women because I'm not a woman. But if I understand the research right, men are lonelier than women. And if we just keep doing that, it's going to break relationships. And so I just want to heavily suggest that what David and Jonathan had was not homosexuality, it was not homoeroticism. It was instead a deep, intimate, loyal, encouraging, self-sacrificial friendship. With language and gestures of love and covenant level commitment. So what can we learn from their friendship? I think there's a few things. I mean, loyal, encouraging, self-sacrificing. Those are good words to have into a friendship, aren't they? What's interesting is that as you read it, and I didn't realize this, it was in that same book that Joanne loaned me, that's book on friends by Austin. He points out that actually this relationship's not very equal. There's a whole pile of love and loyalty and self-sacrifice and all this stuff going from Jonathan to David. Not a whole pile coming back from David. As a matter of fact, when you read all of his relationships, you'll see that David, you know, he doesn't give a whole pile back. Not that he's, you know, this lone guy and all this sort of thing, but it's an unequal relationship. Now listen, here's the thing. In our friendships, they're not always going to be equal. But they can still be good. Sometimes I think that we're in this friendship and we feel if it's not totally reciprocal, if I'm like phoning three times to their phoning me back once, you know, well, I really, you know what, I don't want to be friends, I'm just going to drop it. No, very rare that friendships are completely equal, but they can still be good. Second thing is this idea of covenantal friendship. And this word, this Hebrew word I love, I'm always talking about it. If you haven't been around very long, you maybe haven't heard, but it's this word hesed, which is translated loving kindness or loving faithfulness. And it's a covenantal kind of love. And what we see here between Jonathan and David is hesed. As a matter of fact, they'll call upon each other, practice, do hesed to me, be faithful to me, be loyal to me. As Jonathan, as it's ending, and then he realizes that David's going to be king and the household of Saul is going to fall. And the tradition of the day was that the new king wipes out, eliminates, kills all of the any competition. And so Jonathan's saying, listen, do hesed to me. When you become king, remember our friendship. Be faithful. Don't follow what culture dictates. Don't follow what kings normally do. Don't wipe out my family. Do hesed to me. We're in friendship. We're in covenant. Break every social norm as this carries on. Even as I stood against my father for you, so you stand against culture and the demands and what's practical. And do hesed to me. Don't wipe out my family. Third thing, we see the self-sacrificing, gift-recognizing ability in Jonathan. One of the great things that friends can do to each other is to recognize what is in our friend and to call that out in our friend, to say, this is a gift you have. This is an ability that you have. This is where I see God leading you. As Jonathan did to David, David, listen, man, you're going to be king. I know I was supposed to be in lineup. I know I was supposed to have the job. I know everybody was expecting this. I know it's going to disappoint my dad, but I see this in you. You are a leader. You are a king. You are the one that's going to be the chosen one of God. And one of the best things that we can do as friends is to see in each other what is there, what has God built in, and to call that out and to say, this is what I see in you. This is how God can flow through you. This is what I appreciate for you. And you know what? I'm going to do everything I can to help you achieve that goal, as Jonathan did for David. And the fourth thing that I see in Jonathan and David is that the most intimate words that David has are spoken after Jonathan is dead. There's the other one where it says David wept more than Jonathan. But really, in terms of the expression of his love and intimacy with his friends, it happened after Jonathan was dead. What a sad thing. What a sad thing. To have these deep friendships, how about we have the courage to speak to one another about the importance of that person to you, the importance of this relationship to you, the value you place upon that person, and to speak it out before they're dead, so that you can both rejoice in that relationship. All right, well, Jonathan wasn't the only friend of David's. He had several others, and the other one I thought of was Nathan the prophet. And you remember the big story of David and Nathan, that Nathan is a courageous truth teller. A good friend is a courageous truth teller to our friends. You remember what happened? David doesn't go out with the troops anymore. He's kind of hit middle age. They say, you know, you're getting a bit too old. How about you stay back and we'll go and fight the battle? He does, and he sees Bathsheba. that whole thing that we talked about a few weeks ago, you know, the sexual power play and Me Too time, and he drags Bathsheba in there, has sex with her, she gets pregnant, he kills Uriah. Remember that story? And then what happens is Nathan the prophet, this counselor of David, this one that would stay with him and was with him, comes to him and he tells him the story. Remember the whole story? He said, hey, David, I want to tell you a story. There's this guy, he was really, really rich and he was powerful and he was rich and he had hundreds of sheep, man. He had massive flocks and he was just a rich guy, had everything at his fingertips. And a friend came to visit him, but he didn't want to sacrifice one of his own sheep. Instead, what he did is there was this poor guy in the village and this poor guy had one little lamb. And man, he loved that little lamb. He just nurtured that little lamb. You know what? It was more of a pet to him than anything else. And you know what the rich guy did? He went and he left his own sheep alone and he went and he took that little lamb of that poor guy and he slaughtered it to feed his friend. And David burned with anger, it says, against the man. And he said to Nathan, as surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this must die. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity. And Nathan said to David, you are the man. You are the man. Courageous truth telling. Friends tell hard truths, even if it may endanger the friendship. I love the proverb. Proverbs 27:6 says this, the wounds of a friend can be faithful and trusted, but an enemy multiplies kisses. The wounds of a friend can be trusted. The wounds of a friend are faithful. We speak courageous truth to one another, even if it's difficult, and it takes courage. But I bet you can match me story for the times that you've really grown in your life when somebody who was a good friend, who loved you enough to speak truth into your life, even if maybe you didn't want to hear it. And how often disaster's been averted or good things have happened because somebody cared for me enough to say, hey, Jones, I got to talk to you about this, man. This isn't right. You got to do this, you got to do that. Or, hey man, do you realize the road you're going down? I can't tell you how many times good, faithful friends have said hard things to me and how often it has been the point of growth for my life. There's a whole pile of times, too, where good friends have said things to me and I've ignored their advice and it's ended up in disaster anyway. But the interesting thing is because of faithfulness, they remain friends. Point one, faithfulness. And so to be a friend is to be a courageous truth teller. Well, there's a few more friends we want to look at real quick. And so we're going to just kind of go through this interesting chapter in 2 Samuel chapter 15, if you have your Bibles or your devices. Now, what's happened is, I alluded before about Absalom, you know, trying to usurp the throne, and he gets a bunch of guys to support him, heads toward Jerusalem. David, they're not really sure why, if he was afraid or if he just wanted to save lives. He's going to abandon Jerusalem to fight another day or to figure out what's going on. And so he's heading out in Jerusalem. We want to pick it up with three friends that we want to look at. So it's 1 Samuel chapter 15. You know, Lord Byron called friendship love without his wings. Love without his wings. I like that. And it's because these guys didn't leave David. They didn't abandon him. They stuck with him. So let's look at the first one. The first friend is Ittai, beginning with verse 19. What's happening is that David is leaving the city and all his relatives and supporters are passing in front of him. The king said to Ittai, the Gittite, why should you come along with us? Go back and stay with King Absalom. You are a foreigner, an exile from your own homeland. You came only yesterday. And today, shall I make you wander about with us when I don't know where I'm going? Go back and take your people with you. May the Lord show you kindness and faithfulness. But Ittai replied to the king, as surely as the Lord lives, and as my lord the king lives, wherever my lord the king may be, whether it means life or death, there will your servant be. And David said to Ittai, go ahead. March on. So Ittai the Gittite marched on with all his men and the families who were with him. So Ittai was a Gittai. That means he's from the Philistine city of Gath. Anybody know who else was from the Philistine city of Gath? Goliath. That's exactly right. Kind of interesting. And so David's relationship with the city of God is kind of interesting. You know, he killed Goliath, and later on he fought with them, and he fought against all this sort of thing. And so Ittai was one of these guys from Gath, and he had 600 followers. And there's a couple of things. As Ittai stays with David, he offers up at least a couple of things to him. The first one is that he reminds David of who he is. Did you notice David says, listen, you need to just stay in the city. You're not from here anyway, and you need to serve now King Absalom. And what does Ittai respond to two times? As surely as the Lord lives, I'm going to stay with the king. Well, what he's saying to David is, listen, Absalom is not the king. You are the king. This is your identity. You are the king. It's so helpful for someone sometimes. When a friend says to us, this is who you are. We just sang a song, you know, I am who you say that I am. And so often, it's a helpful thing to say to people who are our friends, who are discouraged, who are in despair, who are lost, this is who you are. You're a child of God. You're my closest friend. You're my neighbor. You're my workmate. You're my whatever. This is who you are. Live into it. And sometimes, on the other side, with the truth telling, when we see somebody